This episode's brought to you by BlueApron.com. Go to BlueApron.com/Trussell to get 3 free, delicious, healthy Blue Apron meals along with free shipping. Blue Apron. Hello, my sweet vibratory chalices of Perceptronium. Tis I, D. Trussell, and thou art listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And no doubt you have barely done anything today because you are still trembling in horror at the catastrophe that happened last night at the Academy Awards. Or as Juliette Goodrich from Channel 5 in San Francisco so aptly put it,
I'm Juliette Goodrich. History was made tonight, and not in a good way.
My dear listeners, it is with great hesitation that I play the following clip, only because I know that it is probably echoing through your mind at 1,000 times per second. And I'm aware that to hear it one more time could be the straw that breaks the camel's back and sends some of you careening out of your cars, out of your homes, out of your offices, out of your subway trains, and into a crowd of horrified onlookers who gaze upon you as you blast explosive diarrhea out of every single one of your orifices and fall to the ground like a deflated, oily, trembling beach ball. And yet, for the sake of this podcast, I feel that I need to play it because I know that there are at least 3 of my listeners who are stationed in various top secret base stations in Antarctica and don't have access to the Academy Awards. So strap in, babies, because here it comes.
And the Academy Award for Best Picture.
You're awesome. Come on. La La Land.
But, you know.
Guys, I'm sorry. No. There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture. Moonlight, Best Picture.
This is not the way things are supposed to happen. There's never a time when a 42-year-old microdosing acid should start rapping. But I'm panicking because it feels like someone from the Academy got distracted at their cabin at the Bohemian Grove, found a treasure trove of butt plugs made out of baby skulls and wrote in the wrong envelope. I don't want to live in this simulation. Don't want to live in this nation. Don't want to live in a place where Warren Beatty gives bad award information. Don't want to be negative, but sometimes it feels like the ray of creation broke a spoke. This has got to be a joke.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke.
I'm gonna find you all individually, and I'm gonna you.
Warren Beatty, how could you betray me when you read the wrong movie, man? You fucking filleted me. Rip my heart out, you broke it into pieces, made me question reality, made me pray to my Jesus. And Jesus didn't say nothing, cause Jesus croaked. Oh God, someone help us. This has gotta be a joke.
This is not a joke. This is not a joke.
This is not a joke.
Ryan Gosling, thank you for making me laugh.
Ceremonies. My sweet friends, today I offer unto you a powerful podcast with a great teacher of the occult, Jason Louvre. I hope you're prepared to enter into the realm of magic We're going to jump right into it. But first, some quick business. April 16th, 2003, David French goes to a local restaurant and orders a bowl of calamari with some barbecue sauce. He takes three bites of the calamari and begins to complain to the waiter about a sudden bout of dizziness. Unbeknownst to French, the calamari had VX nerve agent inside of it. As it turns out, the chef had top secret clearance at one of the local military bases and had come home with a vial of VX nerve agent, which happens to look exactly like barbecue sauce. The chef had been confused and had filled French's barbecue sauce bowl with VX nerve agent. For the next 30 hours, French went through a series of horrific seizures. He bled out of his pores. He clawed his own nipples off and dug his fingers into the holes, desperately trying to poke his own heart to end his life. But he was incapable of this form of suicide because the VX nerve agent had made it impossible for his brain to communicate with his body. This story is one of the many reasons why you should learn to cook at your own home. And thanks to Blue Apron, this is now a possibility. Let's face it, you don't want to die like some cockroach sprayed by poison, twitching away on a hospital floor as you watch your lifeblood pour out of your nipples. And you don't have to, thanks to BlueApron.com. All you got to do is go to BlueApron.com/Trussell, sign up, you'll get... Not only will you get free shipping, but you will also get three free meals. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Trussell. That's what I got to read. But here's my experience with Blue Apron. I have a friend who's made a tradition out of Blue Apron. And he has his friends come over. And he cooks an incredible Blue Apron meal. And he seems like a god on earth. Because these days, a lot of people don't know how to cook. Maybe you're one of those people. Now it's time to learn. You can make it seem like you are someone who climbed down from Mount Olympus. The most perfect human on earth. And for your next date, instead of slopping some crap down your potential wife or husband's mouth, you can give them a delicious meal infused with your love. Thanks to BlueApron.com. Blue Apron. They use the freshest ingredients from local farms. They measure everything out. You don't have to go to the grocery store and scrabble through the garlic aisle looking for Sumerian garlic. They've got it right there for you. BlueApron.com/Trussell. Try them today. Friends, we've got another live DTFH coming up at the Bell House. That's going to be March 21st with Krishna Das. If you don't know who Krishna Das is, go look him up. He's amazing. He's a Kirtanwala. He is a devotee of Neem Karoli Baba. He's amazing. And this is your chance to do some to sing some kirtans. We might do that in the very beginning. And also to find out what is chanting, why it works, what are the roots of chanting, and whatever else we end up talking about. I hope you'll come. The last one with Hamilton Morris was fantastic. I'll be releasing that later this week. It's sold out, so make sure that you get your tickets in advance for Krishna Das because he will definitely sell out. That's March 21st at the Bell House. Ticket links are at duncantrussell.com. Also, much thanks to those of you who still use our Amazon link. All you got to do the next time you're going to buy some beautiful configuration of plastic molecules is go through the link at duncantrussell.com, and the sweet darlings at amazon.com will give us a very small percentage of anything that you buy. What did I just buy at Amazon, you ask? I'll tell you, an Ableton Push 2. If you want to dive into some vortex of electronic music creation, just for no reason at all. I'm just doing it because it seems like, well, I guess I used it on this podcast. So there is some reason behind it. But the way I look at it is, rather than spending all of my time playing Hearthstone, I'll spend 95% of my time playing Hearthstone and the other 5% learning how to make music on the Ableton Push. It's a blast. Check it out if you want a piece of musical equipment that's amazing. Unfortunately, you also have Ableton. You have to have Ableton to go with it. So I don't know. If you're someone who already has Ableton, check it out. I guess that's it. Friends, today's guest is the real deal. He's an author. He's written several books, including Generation Hex, Monsanto Versus the World, The Side Chick Bible, and the Ultra Culture Journal. He also teaches magic and the occult. If you're interested in taking a class with Jason, go to www.magic.me. It's an online school for learning magic. It's got lots of trainings. And if you use the code DTFH, you'll get 30% off your first month of a monthly subscription. So if you feel drawn into the realms of magic and you want to risk your own sanity to experiment with some of the coolest, strangest, subjective modalities out there, then Jason Louvre is a wonderful teacher for you to investigate. Before you do that, why not listen to the podcast and get your mind blown as we talk about John Dee and the Enochian Angels. Now, everybody, please spread those secret wings that you have underneath your shirt. Extend your astral body and send as much love and mana and prana in the direction of one of the premier teachers of the occult living in the world today, the great Jason Louvre. Jason, welcome back to the DTFH. How is your book going?
Hey, Duncan. Just wrapping it up after 2 years of... I haven't left the house for about 2 years, during which time I've only been obsessing on John Dee and the minutiae of Christian apocalypticism and only occasionally breaking to play Dungeons and Dragons, my true love in this world.
Can you tell people who John Dee is?
So John Dee was the magical advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, and he was a guy who knew everything at a time when it was still possible to know everything in the world, because we were just entering, or just in the Renaissance, basically. And humanity, or at least European civilization, was just starting to reclaim its knowledge after it was all lost in the Dark Ages. So he was a guy who wanted to know everything, and that included mathematics and navigation, geography, and the occult. And so he's probably, in my opinion, you know, certainly the most advanced occult thinker of the Renaissance. And since Western culture kind of just ditched the idea of the occult and magic after the Scientific Revolution, that means he's still one of the most advanced thinkers on the topic. Huh. So this is the guy that is a great fascination to me, particularly because he's also the guy that came up with the phrase the British Empire. And he's the person who's responsible for essentially the plan to create a British Empire. So it's thanks to him that we're here today, in a way, in the current, you know, the current world order, the new world order, as you might put it, is his creation. I kind of think of him as like the architect in the Matrix, to use to make the tacky, do the tacky thing of using a Matrix metaphor.
In that time period, did people view the occult in the same way as they do today? I mean, I know probably people thought there was more validity in some of the ideas that now are considered to be rubbish. But
yes,
was it considered during that time period to be an off-limits kind of thing that you weren't supposed to investigate or get into?
For average people, yes, absolutely. I mean, people were still extremely superstitious. You have to remember that this is a time period where people thought that math was the work of the devil. And John Dee was also one of the first people to popularize math, which people were just as terrified of as the occult. But for the elite, for the educated, for the academic high registers of society, it was the central concern. People were obsessed with the idea of Hermeticism, Renaissance Neoplatonism, as it's called. And, you know, magic, the occult directly trying to make experiments to influence reality using Kabbalistic techniques or, you know, techniques drawn from the grimoires.
Do you think
so? It was the central thing.
So the royal families were casting spells.
Elizabeth was first of all, a genius. This is a woman who was known even as an eight-year-old when she was being tutored. She could, in her spare time, she would translate Latin into Greek and back into Greek in her head.
This isn't just government, or this isn't propaganda. You think this is real? It sounds a little bit like Kim Jong-il or like legends people build.
Well, maybe. Okay, so there's that, and we would have to go back and look closely. But it's definitely a historical record that Elizabeth in particular was extremely interested in Hermeticism and alchemy. She really wanted to find the Philosopher's Stone primarily in order to cure her smallpox and also extend her lifespan. But she was constantly getting into trouble, falling for the claims of people who showed up claiming they could make gold. Because obviously there was like a real gold rush. People were sinking tons and tons of money all over Europe into solving the secrets of alchemy, because whoever figured that out first would essentially have infinite money and have the economic advantage over everyone else.
Right.
So they were very, very, very interested in it, but primarily for that reason, which was, can we make infinite money?
You know, there's an interesting parallel between the current attempt by like Google to create an AI, a strong AI.
Yes.
It's a similar thing, because the moment a corporation has a super intelligence theoretically at their beck and call, I mean, that's the thing everyone's worried about, is why would it listen to you? But then they have this severe advantage over every other corporation. So it's a curious repetition, only now instead of trying to turn lead into gold, we're trying to turn computers into mines, you know? But it's like a similar kind of alchemy. But to get back to...
Yes. Well, I think that I'm glad you touched on that, though, because I think the parallels are incredible. Even during the Renaissance, it was in the Italian city states with the Medici's were the ones who really first put a lot of funding into figuring this stuff out. The Italian city states are very similar to Silicon Valley now, where it's a small group of people with extreme amount of money who are kind of in this heightened position over everyone else in society. And they're trying to figure out this kind of Faustian thing that will give them a permanent advantage. So I think the parallels are there. I think that it also just demonstrates this ongoing theme in Western culture, this kind of Faustian thing that seems to be part of, Western civilization, where people are constantly trying to do something, figure something out, or do something that's maybe not a good idea.
Always. Something that you just don't know what if you did figure out a way to transform lead into gold, you're not going to hold on to that recipe forever. Everyone's going to want it. And the moment people see that it can be done, then that will only make people more enthusiastic in the pursuit of whatever the formula is. But essentially you just wreck the market, right? Like this is what happened to aluminum would happen to gold. It's like, who gives a fuck? Everyone has gold. Like gold is everywhere now. So it just never happened. So gold is still valuable. But so to get back to John Dee, where did he come from? How does a person become a court magician? Was that what he was called, or was he called an advisor?
Yeah, he was I think his technical title was the astrological advisor to Elizabeth. He, he's often romanticized by people who look at him. But the reality is he was a fairly poorly paid government consultant. They were never, they took advantage of him quite a bit. He was never getting properly funded. This is still the time in England where there was no funding for science. He was an academic. But because he was never treated properly... he worked tirelessly for England up until his 50s, but because he was never really paid or treated properly, and he kind of fell out of favor at court because they considered his imperial plans fanciful and not particularly serious, even though they later used them. And once his career kind of fell apart, he retreated totally into the world of the occult, and over about 10 years with a guy named Edward Kelly, was doing nothing except trying to communicate with angels, which is what most people know him for today, which is a bizarre story.
Is that, are the angels he was trying to communicate with, that's the Enochian spirits? Is that what that is?
Yes.
Now, yes, that's what it's called today. Help me understand. I am so foggy on what that is, and yet it's a thing that pops up all the time.
Okay. So Enochian is a modern word. Dee did not use it. He was just saying he was talking to angels. But essentially what they were doing is, so he was working with a scryer, and a scryer is essentially a psychic. It's somebody who has the, what we would now consider like the visionary faculty to go into trance states and experience kind of internal visions. This is something we know today from the, you know, people have all kinds of ways of doing this now, chemical or otherwise, but at the time people were primarily, you know, they had more rudimentary ways of doing it.
What were they? Were they taking psychoactives back then, or what was their formula?
I tried to figure that out. I think that I'm not there's a lot that suggests they may have
belladonna.
Yeah, totally. And also, I mean, magic mushrooms and cannabis grow naturally in England. You know, they grow, like, their English mushrooms are extremely bizarre. You know, they look crafty.
But if they were using that stuff, it's weird because you would think, why would they hide that? Or you would think that would just be a known fact. Like, in those days, right, if people were scrying, it just seems like they would just announce, yeah, we eat mushrooms when we do this, but you never hear about it.
Or they would have done something like, yes, we prepared the alchemical tincture of the philosopher's stone into the, you know, they would use some bizarre alchemical language, but there's really not anything like that in the records. Huh. So I don't know, but it's possible because Kelly is constantly like going off the rails and having bad trips and just like losing his gourd. So that kind of suggests they might have been partaking.
Yeah. Right. You know, but that, you know what it brings to mind? It brings to mind, Pendleton Ward, who I think the first time he was on the podcast, I asked the rather, what I now understand to be a very rude question to ask an artist, which is, how high were you when you thought of that, man? And like a lot of time, and like Pendleton's like, I wasn't at all. I don't need to get high to think of Adventure Time. I don't need that. So a lot, and, you know, many artists, when you insinuate that they must have been under the effect of a psychedelic, it's not like they get ruffled, but they're just like, no, you think you need that, but you don't. I mean, maybe it's scarier to think that you can access these angels with no psychoactive chemicals and with no tinctures, that if you just knew the correct procedure, then you could immediately commune with the spirits.
Right. Well, look, I mean, you know, magic is a funny word, but magic itself is a set of techniques for doing that without chemicals. I mean, it's a set of techniques for entering altered states of consciousness and things like yoga poses or pranayama, over breathing, or, you know, what's called astral travel, which is kind of really just guided visualization. All of those techniques are for entering these states of consciousness. And scrying itself, which is staring at a crystal ball or a black mirror until you basically just kind of trance out and enter a visionary state. All of these things are methods for getting out of your own way. And if you're good at that, you know, particularly if you're an artist, if you're someone who stays in creative states of mind a lot, that's pretty easy. You know, I think it's particularly people who are hyper rational or more scientifically minded often have a problem dropping their own suspension of disbelief in a way, or allowing themselves to experience those things. But they're you know, all it really is a matter of allowing yourself to experience it. You know,
right. Yeah, that's right. That is so crazy. I mean, that I think this is definitely something people just don't want to deal with. They don't want to deal with the fact that the membrane surrounding them and creating whatever kind of like subjective biosphere that they've been living in is completely transformable, permeable. You can just take that thing down and suddenly you have entered into the vortex. Suddenly you're surrounded and you're in the mind of God. That's I don't think people want to know that. I think they would rather just not know that every single thing around them that they consider to be rational is just a kind of defense mechanism to protect them from the raging cyclone of spirit that surrounds all of us.
Yes. Well, we're in the mind of God all the time. We've just forgotten that. You know, and when we're in altered states, we're just in a different, you know, a different density of the mind of God. We're in the imaginary part, the part that looks like imaginary to us, you know, that operates like a cartoon and is a little bit more, has different rules, you know, but everything is part of the mind of God.
Let me ask
you, I think you're totally
this.
Right about that.
I want to ask, and that brings, just, this is going to sound like such a pithy question, but I got to ask it. If we're in the mind of God, and we've forgotten that, does that mean that God has forgotten us? Is like when, in other words, is a result of God forgetting aspects of God's creation that their creation simultaneously forget the progenitor of the creation? Or do you think that in the mind of God, we are always held in remembrance?
Well, I think we are, but it's also a question of, have we forgotten or are we just pretending to have forgotten? You know, it's like when you go into a movie, you know, have you really forgotten it's a movie, or are you pretending it's that you don't know it's a movie so that it's more fun to watch?
Right. Yeah. And it's not just with the movies, it's with a lot of things, right? The human tendency to deceive the self.
Right.
And we have so many reasons for doing that, you know, that are go way beyond enjoying, like, to enjoy your life, you need to, in other words, like, if I want to live in a world where I'm an okay person, then I need to forget some shit that I've done, right?
You know, yes.
You know, like, you got to forget, like, you can't,
oh,
like.
It's too real, Duncan. It's too real.
It's real. I mean, it is. And, yeah. But you know, the time that you, like, I don't know, like kicked the dog, or like, oh, you know what? Here's a real basic example. Every time you sit down for a nice steak, you know, like,
right,
you have got right. to forget what the fuck you're eating. And if you don't, I mean, some people be like, I don't forget. I relish that I'm eating the flesh of a beast. But like that's not most of us. Most of us like to sit down to a meal. I like, if I go to a steakhouse, I am one of the few places where I'm still offended is when a steakhouse puts pictures of cows on the wall. It's like, wow, why are you doing
that?
Why?
Yeah.
So okay, so self.
Well, this is kind of like like we always see. You know, especially when reading New Age stuff and things like that, we're always getting this propaganda of just like, yeah, you know, wake up and experience, you know, you need to wake up, sheeple, you know.
Yes.
But then the more you do that, the more you're like, oh, this actually, you know, I don't want to be aware of the fact that I'm going to die every waking second of the day. You know, I don't want to be aware of the fact that we're sliding into some type of inevitable global catastrophe possibly within our lifetimes. You know, like, I don't want to think about humanity living as enslaved beings to bizarre, you know, technological creations. You know, it becomes too much. And I think this is what Lovecraft was talking about, where he said something like, to the effect of, the most merciful thing in the world is the inability of the human mind to correlate its own contents.
Oh, wow. Yeah, right. I mean, this is in the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna reveals his universal form and Arjuna says to Krishna, can you please just go back to being your normal forearm self? Because this fucking massive thing you just showed me, I can't deal with it. And yet, but this is the occult, isn't it? It's the process of overcoming that fear, right? The fear of accepting reality as reality truly is, not as the part of you that's deceiving yourself wants to make it.
So I think that Dee and Kelly make a really fascinating study of this, because Dee actually, and this dynamic played out in their relationship, because Dee is your kind of quintessential like Reddit fedora guy, where he's hyper-rational. He's, and even though he had studied the minutiae of the occult and mathematics and Greek and Latin and Kabbalah and all this stuff for decades, and was the most knowledgeable person in England on this, he had five times the books of Cambridge and Oxford and all this. But at the same time, he couldn't get out of his own way. He was too rational. He could not actually see anything or make contact with spirits. It didn't work. So he had to employ scryers, who were these kind of unhinged, itinerant people who were, you know, Kelly was half D's age, an alcoholic, overweight, was probably mentally ill, you know, when had was a criminal, all this stuff. You know, he was had been accused of necromancy and trafficking with demons, which he had actually done, and all this stuff. So he's this very shady character, but he could do it. He could see these realities, and so they formed a working partnership, which really is the way the magic is best done. I think it's best done in groups. But
you don't think it can be done as an individual practitioner?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But parts of it seem to work better with when you have more than one person. But that's neither here nor there. I think that but Dee and Kelly, once they made contact with the angels, I mean, Dee thought, you know, basically his view was, I'm smarter than everybody, so I'm going to, you know, the only people left that I have to learn from are the angels themselves. They're really going to tell me what's going on.
This is so wild, man. It is, I don't mean to go back to an earlier point, but it is so wild to me that we are continuing this cycle in our attempt to create a powerful, a strong AI. It is, you know, because what is that? D wants to communicate with a higher intelligence. In this case, it's angels, right? But right. We want to communicate with a higher intelligence. In this case, we call it an artificial intelligence, which is a hilarious word for it. And yet still, we want to talk to the angels. This is seems to just be built into human beings. Our language for describing our attempts at communicating with these beings has massively changed. Right. Yes. Like now the way we talk to the angels is with a large hadron collider, you know, or with like these the incredible scopes and tools that we have to peer into the depths of the universe. But still, it's fucked,
yes.
Man.
And the fascinating thing with that is that all of these things you're talking about, like science itself, comes out of D, and not just D, but the alchemists and the hermeticists and the neoplatonists and the people who are trying to do the occult. There's a straight line. Continuum from them to here. It's all the same impulse.
Wow.
Right? But that's been kind of covered up by, you know, they don't teach you that in high school because it's so out there.
They don't like it. They don't like it. When you look into Isaac Newton, for example.
Yes.
And you realize that, like, Isaac Newton was, like, studying the Temple of Solomon, hair filled with mercury. A crazy, you know, occultist, you know, for some reason it's like people who don't want to admit that we were monkeys at one point, like hardcore scientists don't seem to like the fact that the roots of science go deep into the alchemical laboratories of people like John Dee, who was hanging out with lunatic alcoholics talking to angels.
Right. It drives people crazy to even hear about that. But at the same time, I think that we've lost a lot because, it's been fascinating for me to study people like Dee and Newton. I mean, Newton and Dee basically had the exact same way of seeing the world. It was the Renaissance scientific model is very consistent. These people are not outliers. You know, they're particularly smart, but they're in a part of a tradition, which is essentially seeing the universe as the mind of God, and therefore seeing things like math and science and optics and like basically seeing that everything is one thing, and what we perceive to be, you know, there's not a split between scientific reasoning and spirituality. We're just studying the universe. Right. That's really what it is. And so they're all in this tradition. And I think that we've lost that, and I think that that's to our great loss, particularly with things like AI. And I think if you look at many of the great spiritual teachers, particularly of the 20th century, whether it's Manly Hall or Ananda or people like this, have been saying this thing to us over and over again, which is humanity's capacity to create technological wonders is far outpacing its wisdom and its ability to handle it. And things like the atomic bomb or AI, you know, I can't think of a much more dramatic demonstration of that.
Yeah.
So we need the spirit. We need the soul.
Yeah. When humanity leaves science, you just have this mantis, this thing that's just manipulating matter with no thought at all. And this is one of the things that I love about magic. And I think we talked about this on the phone briefly, but I'm reading this book. Well, I stopped reading it, but by Eliphas Levi, is that how you say his name, Jason?
Levy, yes. Yeah,
Eliphas Levy. Yeah. And how in these grimoires, there's inevitably some warning about the dangers of exploring this particular process and the respect that you need to enter into the practice with. This is somewhat even in Chogyam Trungpa and Eastern teachers too. And this creates a feeling of like, you know, be careful. This is not, we're not fucking around here. This is real. And yet in science, people seem to just not have any care at all.
Right.
About, right. You know, right. I mean, this just popped up on Reddit WTF, this like decapitator for mice. I don't know if you've seen that. Have you seen that?
Oh God. I don't know if I want to.
It's just, it looks like a, it's like a little plastic ice That's cream so cone. That you can shove the mouse into, and its little head is at the end, and then in that it's shoved into this little plastic ice cream cone. You can inject it, you can decapitate it, and you know this is a thing that's like on some scientific website just on sale, you know, because like at some point or another example, I was having this conversation with someone, and they were like, "Dogs do not feel love." Dogs do not feel love. They could never feel love. They just want food. And like, you know what I
have
mean?
Have you ever spent time with a dog?
Yeah. It's like, what the fuck? What have a shitty dog is all, man. You can't judge. But again, that kind of like mantis-like, I don't even mean to insult praying mantises, but that kind of insectoid, emotionless, mechanistic view of the universe is so disastrous.
Yes.
Yes. And what?
Matt, Duncan, I was going to send you this video clip, but I didn't want to mess with you too hard because, you know, sometimes like people will send me clips and I'll be like in a certain state of mind and it's like really not the right time to see that.
Right.
But it was a fully automated AI meat processing plant where it was just like this huge factory just like processing like carcasses. You know, there's no people in it. It's just machinery.
It's like our stomachs. It's like what our stomachs do. Oh my God. Yeah.
It's like watching this like H.R. Geiger, Francis Bacon vision of the future of.
please send it. Yeah. No, because that's what will happen. Well, you know what? It's one day we're all, when you walk to the park, you're going to try to ignore the humming of the master drone as it descends and carries away a child and drops it into a chute. In some kind of factory where the child is processed, you know, organs harvested, eyeballs harvested. But it's like probably the AI will be like, "Do not worry, we will retain, we will save its memories. We will replace the child with a child that is indistinguishable from the meat child that we used for our experiments. You should be honored." But anyway,
so frightening.
It's so
Like. Sorry, I think that like, but just sort of going off what you said, I mean, you said that you know, magic is, you know, there are always warnings that people are said it's, you know, it's dangerous to mess with. But you know what? I also think it's dangerous not to investigate it, because I think that, you know, it's dangerous to not have a knowledge of the spirit or yourself or the spiritual world. It's dangerous to, you know, it's like, yeah, like it's dangerous to ride a, you know, it's dangerous to learn how to ride a bike. It's dangerous to learn how to, it's dangerous to go outside, you know, because you're going to meet some people who are cool and some people who are like totally, you know, trying to rip you off and take advantage of you or just crazy. And it's the same way with the spiritual world, if you want to call it that, or the astral world. It's like, but you can't understand the difference until you've experienced it, until you have experience of what works and what doesn't. So I also think that, you know, it's dangerous not to engage in these things. And I think that our culture, the fact that after the Industrial Revolution, after the birth of modern science, you know, that our culture just slammed the door on these things. Yeah. I think that that's also a failing. I think that's also dangerous.
It is. I mean, it kind of reminds me of what when Terrence McKenna said he feels sorry for people who've never taken mushrooms, that he looks at people who've never taken a psychedelic in the same way he might look at someone who died having never had an orgasm or never had sex, or, you know, like a person who never, because it's such an essential part of being a human, and the theophany or whatever you want to call it, that state of awe and dread and fear that comes when you enter into some magical ritual. I mean, I've my experience with the actual magical ritual is limited to, I don't know, three or four real ones, and three. And then the reason I can, those three are so frozen in my mind, you know, as terrifying. And
why was it terrifying?
You know, because it's the sense of like pushing through some, like, you know, I the way I would do it, you know, again, probably the way you do it is would be way, way more terrifying. I mean, I'm sure you've seen, I'm sure you've done some stuff, man, seen some stuff. But, so when I would do it, the times I have done it, it's the feeling for me of a presence being in the room that isn't me anymore. That sense of being watched, or a palatable sense of a tension in the air that wasn't there before, a feeling of like, I don't know what that is. And then,
well, it's a spirit manifesting. That's what it feels like.
Ooh, and that's scary because when that happens, it's no longer like, one of those Ouija board shows, you know, like it's the same way as though you've opened your door and someone has walked into the room. And then it's like, fuck, are you going to leave? Like, what did I just, you know, that it's that sense. But then there's also the, a feeling of instinctuality about it. Like, oh, this is something I kind of know how to do. And then there's the, at least for me, and maybe this is going back to our own self-deception, in these moments, I have gone into a kind of amnesic state where, like, on the other side, it'll be like, what the fuck did I do? You know, like, there was a moment in there of, like, I don't know what that was. And then, of course, the next part of it that's terrifying is when the result happens. And then, and now you're dealing with a world where it's like, wait, what the fuck? Not only did I do a thing, and now here is an immediate result, you know? And then you're dealing, now you're in a world where you have no long, you can't deny it because it's too perfect. And it happens, you know what I'm talking about, right? All of that,
yeah,
my reaction,
totally.
That,
of course.
It's scary.
Of course. It's scary. It always reminds me of, you know, the magical consciousness is just such a strange, you know, it's such a strange, and exactly what you're saying, very familiar in a way, because it's very, it's very strange, but it's also essentially how we thought when we were small children. You know, it's the same type of logic, you know, where we're interacting with imaginary friends or taking kind of strange ritualistic actions because you think they're going to make something happen. But it always reminds me of like Twin Peaks when they go into the Black Lodge. We've got like the little man from another place walking around, like that weird way that David Lynch has spirits, like just say like really strange and like meaningless things.
Yes,
like it felt, it always feels kind of like that to me.
That's a, I've always thought Lynch must do some kind of practice. I mean, he calls it a lodge, you know, like he clearly does something.
Or well, that was all. Well, David Lynch is a transcendental meditation guy, but all that was Mark Frost, the screenwriter, who was hardcore into theosophy. And he put all this theosophical stuff into Twin Peaks.
What? No way. I thought that was all Lynch. Holy shit. That's
crazy. No, it's Mark Frost.
Wow. Oh my God.
That's a great writer, by the way. I recommend his, he wrote some novels too that are really good.
Oh, beautiful. I'll check it out. Hey, let's get back to John Dee. Okay. I want to talk about, you know, speaking of rituals and stuff like this, it is best, how do I say this? Can you describe what one of these rituals might have looked like? Can you describe to me, describe the room, describe the like time, just as clearly as you can. I want to be able to see one of these rituals in my mind.
So they were actually incredibly simple, which is kind of paradoxical because the material they got was so complex, but the actual rituals they were doing were much, much more simple than what you normally see in Kabors. It had much more, it was closer to prayer. But so John Dee had a house named a house in a town or a suburb of London, northwest London, called Mortlake, which I visited this summer. It was very cool to see it. It's right on the Thames. So he had this large house in a quiet suburban neighborhood by the river, you know, very tranquil environment, next to a church. But it was a large house. He had a big family. He had a wife. And I think by the end of his life, he had something like 9 kids. So there were several kids running around, and then Kelly was there, and Kelly's wife was there, and then there were servants. So it was a big household. There were a lot of people there. And John Dee had a study where he set up this scrying table or a scrying ball. And Kelly would basically go into John Dee's study and they would close the doors. They had the two heavy doors, but it would be during the day.
A scrying table? So the entire table is this like black reflective surface?
So the angels, as the sessions progressed, the angels gave them instructions on how to build what is essentially the most complicated Ouija board you've ever seen. It's this gigantic 3-foot by 3-foot table with sigils all over it and wax seals and aluminum engraving. And it's this incredibly complex thing.
This is called the Enochian Spirit Board, right?
Well, it's called the Holy Table of Practice.
Oh, the Holy Table of Practice. Because I've heard that like the drummer of Tool has one of these things over his like drum set or something. Could be a rumor.
He may. So he has the sigillum, I think, which is one specific part of that. And that's just a wax seal about the size of a pie plate. And on top of, but you set all this up, that part goes on top of the table, and then a small scrying ball about an inch or 2 inches or a black mirror goes on top of that. And so all of this stuff is essentially to support a crystal. But they didn't start out with that stuff.
This is insane, man. I see. I just Google searched Holy Table of Practice. What? That is crazy. Yeah. Okay, keep going. Sorry. So angels had instructed them.
Yes. So the first 1 or 2 years, or maybe 3 years of these sessions, were just the angels telling them how to build this thing.
Wow.
But they started off with just a scrying ball, and they would do it in daylight. John Dee was very into optics and the study of, which is the study of, you know, telescopes and mirrors and that type of thing. So he'd been obsessed with this for a long time. But they scryed in a busy house in daylight. It was not spooky. It was not like a Hammer horror thing. And they would usually have light, daylight reflecting into the scrying ball.
Hey, but listen, man, I'm sorry. I'm looking at what Holy Table is scrying right now. I don't care what time of the day you're doing that. That does not look not spooky.
It's intense.
Do you have one of these, Jason?
Yeah, I made one. It took me about a year.
Wow. Okay, go ahead. So they're sitting it's in the day. Light is shining through the window into this crystal.
Yes. But essentially, as far as ritual went, it would basically be John Dee would kneel. He would pray at length. He would confess his sins to Christ. It was very extremely Christian in nature. And he would essentially grovel. And this is a standard feature of medieval and Renaissance magic is sanctification, which is the humbling of yourself before God.
Wow.
And so he would basically get on his knees and pray, you know, at length, to I, John Dee, am a poor mortal sinner. Please look kindly upon me. And if I am seen to be fit, then perhaps you would send one of your angels to further instruct me in how to be, you know, how to better live in your holy church.
Beautiful.
But you can see his speeches, they were long and extremely long and so on. And if you've ever done this type of thing, if you've prayed in church or you've sincerely prayed even outside of the context of ritual, you know it's extremely consciousness altering. You know, it really does something to your sense of yourself. You know, even to humble yourself and to put yourself in a subservient position is so important, and it's often missed in modern magic, which is so kind of like egoic and self-centered often.
Right.
So he would do this, and then he would just directly petition and say, please send an angel. And then Kelly would enter a trance and begin scrying in the ball and say what he was seeing, and John Dee would write it down. And usually the sessions would last, you know, 20 minutes to an hour, and they'd usually do them once or twice a day. And they'd take breaks in between, and things would get, you know, like things would happen, like chaos would happen, or Kelly would start to lose his nut. So there's long breaks in the sessions, but they basically did this from 1581 to about 1587 consistently.
Holy shit. Go ahead, sorry.
And so there's, you know, probably about 1,000 pages of records of what they wrote down.
What are the topics that these angels felt they needed to talk about with John Dee?
So the angels were, so here's the thing, right? They weren't friendly. or they were friendly, but, you know, they were very Old Testament. Let's put it that. I mean, basically, essentially their message was the end of the world is at hand. You know, the Antichrist is soon to be born. The second coming is at hand, and the world is awash in its sin and its fallen nature, and everything has fallen from the grace of God and must be rectified. It must be, you know, it was very like unhinged street preacher, and so most of those sessions are them, you know, lashing both Dee and Kelly for their sins and their. You know, it's clear that the angels, even though Dee is probably the most intelligent person in Europe at this point, it's clear that the angels see him as a, you know, a convenient but often hard to discipline dog. You know, they just look like lower animals to these beings. And so there's lots of comedic sections where Dee and Kelly are just kind of stumbling over themselves. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. And they're like asking for money, and the angels are like, what are you, you know, we're giving you the secrets of the universe and you're asking us for money. What are you talking about? And then Kelly asked to borrow money from the angels at one point. it's funny. It's extremely comedic. It's just like these two, it's all of a sudden turns into like Three Stooges, you know, because these two guys are just so outclassed by these beings.
What is the response? When you've been summoned into a room by these monkey descendants, how does an angel respond to, how would you borrow money from an angel?
Well, they're constantly just losing their cool. They start off, they show up and they start elaborating these long, beautiful passages, which are, you know, the language is just, you know, as Crowley later said, you know, it's on par with Milton or the Bible. It's just beautiful, this beautiful language. But then Dee and Kelly are just like, you know, can you hold on a sec? We need to have dinner, you know, or like they're constantly asking for money and all this. And so the angels just get more and more fed up as these sessions go on.
Wow.
And they lose their patience very quickly.
Holy shit, man. That's so... Have you ever contacted any of these beings before? Have you... You've clearly spent some time working on the implement that you... The tools. Have you had success in contacting any of these angels?
I've definitely done a lot of... This is interesting because I wrote about this, I've written about this before. There's a book called Ultra Culture Journal, which is on Amazon, where I wrote about some of my experiences with Enochian. And I would say yes, I think that my experiences with this stuff are, it's just really weird. And my experiences have not been similar to Dee and Kelly's. They've been very different. So, but it's very weird is probably the best way I can put it.
Weird.
It's very hard. It's very, you know, there's a real current of, you know, I gave a presentation on this recently in Seattle, and I was talking about Enochian, and the difference between Enochian magic and other types of magic is, you know, a lot of people get into magic with this idea that they're going to use it to get things, or they're going to, you know, they're going to do a ritual to get a job or a girl, or they're going to become this charismatic person, or, you know, whatever reason people have for getting into this stuff.
Yes.
And the grimoires promise you all these things.
Yes.
Enochian has one function, it seems, which is to destroy you completely.
Why?
But because it's the point of Enochian is destroying the individual ego.
Huh.
You know, in the same way that hardcore meditation or hardcore psychedelic experience or... You know, but if the destruction of the ego accessed through the fire and brimstone of the Old Testament.
God,
so it's something. It's special.
Were there words that you heard, or did you see a thing? Was it just feeling?
Well, it depends on the ritual. It's I think the best way to describe it is you know, entering an altered state of consciousness and experiencing kind of a trip.
Do you feel like it's a private matter that you don't want to discuss? Is it private?
For the most part. I mean, I've talked about it a little bit in my books, but also I think that I tend not to like to talk about specific rituals also because I don't want to, I would rather people try things themselves and come to their own conclusions than kind of like pregame them, right? And kind of like give them something. Because I've noticed with myself a lot too, where I'll do something and then I'll think I've experienced something and then I'll go back and I'll realize it's something that I read previously.
Right.
And so things can blur, and it's good to get like, it's good to get like a good, you know, as close to experimentally viable conditions as possible.
I gotcha. Yeah. But sometimes I think though, when you, so yeah, you have an experience and then you like, then you realize like, oh shit, I saw that in Nightbreed or whatever, you know, like, I saw that in a movie. That's not really me. That wasn't real. But sometimes I think...
sort of. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, yeah. It feels like the mind... okay, so like the mind, when it comes into contact with the unknown, it uses symbols that are known.
Yes.
Right? So in that way, your mind is like grabbing the closest thing it has to articulating the contact, which is why you will experience things that you may have seen in a movie, but that doesn't invalidate it. It's just, that's what your mind, that's the closest to your mind. That's like, you know, if I've got a palette of, you know, colors, I can paint something, but I can only paint using the colors that I have, you know?
Right.
So, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you're having a heightened experience in your own nervous system, but your own nervous system is contacting, you know, a new part of the brain or a new experience or whatever you believe these things actually are.
Is the jury out for you, Jason, still?
I think it depends on the day.
All right.
I think that I would say at this point in my life, I think that there are, so what's a good way to put this? For me, the question of the objective reality of what we would call spirits and the, or other beings, and the objective reality of existence itself are the same question. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Within the bounds of my own experience, this stuff is absolutely real, you know, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But then you have to ask, okay, well, but how much of what we actually perceive is real at all anyways?
Right.
You know, it's still part of our sensory input. You know, if you read philosophers like Bishop Berkeley or David Hume, they're based, or even later on in a way, Wittgenstein, where they're saying it's like, you know, you really don't contact anything outside of your own sensory field at any time. Everything that you're seeing right now is just your brain's representation of something from a sensory organ. It doesn't mean it's real. It's just that you're the jelly, you know, the gelatinous mass that you happen to be in this time and space is interpreting sensory input in a way that allows it to survive.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's actually objectively real. You know, and it's the same way with, you know, heightened states of consciousness or astral things or virtual reality or any of it. It's like, it's still you. It's still your nervous system. So that's when we start to get into the realms of ontology and philosophy and all that. But I think practically speaking, you know, is this stuff real? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's where I'm at with it too, is, and it is like some days I just think, oh, you're fooling yourself, man. Just a blur of chaos. And your brain's like desperately trying to make up some bullshit just to ease the suffering of existence or something. But then when the experiences come, you realize how just ridiculous that rationalization or that form of rationalization is when you are really in the presence of a thing that is way smarter than you, so much smarter than you, and and it's not you. That is,
well, even if it's a part of you that you don't normally access because you're in the social trance that tells you don't have access to it.
Right.
So even if it's just, but even if it's just a part of you that it, you know, even if there's, even if just like, let's say that creating, you know, let's say that creating ritual conditions, like setting up a room to do a ritual and putting yourself in the mind frame and putting on whatever clothes you do, whatever it is that gets you there. Let's say that you're just tapping a part of you that you normally don't. Okay, well, that's pretty freaking awesome right there.
Sure.
You know, because now it's like, well, great. Well, now you have a way of, and maybe you could even simplify it once you understand what it is. Maybe you can simplify it down to a phrase or or a gesture that gets you there. But man, if you can get yourself into, what might more rationally be called the unconscious mind, in the way that an artist does when they're painting, or an athlete does when they're in peak performance states. It's like, man, even that is pretty freaking awesome, you know?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And this is, there is a precedent for this in just the normal developmental process of a human being. Because do you remember, I don't know if you remember this, you remember like when you first found out that there was this thing called an orgasm that could happen to you? Do you remember that?
A Glorious Day involving an early X-Men comic, I think, but we won't go there.
There you go. Yeah. But there was a time when I was a kid, and like I remember hearing, you can come. Like, you can come. There's an orgasm you can have. And like, it's something you've never experienced, but you hear that you can. And then when it finally happens, you're like, what the fuck? This is a possibility? This extreme state of pleasure is a possibility. So in the same way, why do we think it stops there?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's great, man. I think I've thought about it in those terms a lot, actually. That's really interesting. And I think that it's such a valid comparison. And I think yoga is similar too. I mean, like, I don't know if you've done pranayama at all.
I've dabbled in it, but I don't understand how to do it. Maybe you could explain it to me a little bit, because all I know is that
it really helps to have somebody show you in person, which
right.
is because you can mess yourself up if you do it wrong.
Really?
But if you get really good at it, if you spend a year or two practicing it and you get really good at it, or you get a high lung capacity, man, it's like you can trigger like heroin experiences in your brain, for free at the drop of a hat. And you can do things to your nervous system. And not just pranayama, but and that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in all this stuff. It's like, I like getting high in weird ways,
Right.
So like, so pranayama or neuro-linguistic programming or, Sufi dancing or, whatever, or rituals like we're talking about. It's not just the spooky thing. I mean, like, there's all these techniques for doing essentially what you're having, triggering these, intense, strange, ecstatic and bewildering experiences within your own nervous system.
Wait, I don't understand how NLP could trigger these experiences. I must not understand neuro-linguistic programming, because I thought that was more of a social tool of like manipulation or something.
Unfortunately, this is how people use it, because people always use things for the most selfish reasons, right? But if you really study NLP, I mean, you can, NLP and hypnosis, you can get yourself into, it's just stripped down magic in a way. It's magic without all these ritual tools and extra robes and all this window dressing. It's a way of using language and the body to directly get yourself into hyped up states of consciousness.
What does that look like? I mean, what do you talk to yourself, or how does that?
Well, usually it's one person talking to another, somebody guiding somebody into that state.
Whoa, huh. Interesting, had no idea. Yeah. Wow. So these.
People have used it for this like dumb pickup artist reason, which is just, embarrassing. But
yeah, because people never use magic for that kind of stuff, right, Jason? No one's ever used magic for that. What?
I haven't since I was a teenager. So.
Well, yeah, but that's when one of the great mistakes you can make is to try to use magic for that purpose. That's a real, that's a surefire way to fuck your life up, man.
Well, not fuck your life up. I mean, to have a mistake and learn from it. And I think but it's like the same thing, at least my view of these things, it's the same thing with NLP or magic or, these people who are like, what if I can just get somebody to like me? And, they approach these things in a manipulative way. But pretty soon you figure out it's like, that's not really how the universe works. I mean, the way the universe works is like, if you can turn yourself into an awesome person using these things, then people will just be naturally attracted to you.
Right.
You don't need to force something.
How sad that people forget that very simple truth. Isn't that the saddest thing, that people try to like polish the mask, or they try to like rework the very shallowest part of their self and without even gazing in at the hornet's nest inside of them. And like, it's such a sad thing to me that I guess it's just easier, right? To like, it's easier work if you think, I all I have to do is put on a different mask and people will like me.
You think it's easier, but it's actually not.
Right.
It's actually, it just is a hornet's nest, as you say. But you know, it's a developmental stage. People go through it, and then they learn, and then they go on to the next thing. You know, people are processes. Hopefully they don't get stuck there.
Do you foresee a time in our future? Do you think we have a future? No. Do you foresee a
time? Here we go.
Do you foresee a time in the future where there will be a renaissance with these kinds of practices, or a place where technology and these things merge? When you're describing this Enochian, what do you call it? A practice? What's it called? The Enochian spirit table, or what's it called?
Yeah.
One thing that came to mind right away is like, man, someone needs to build one of these in virtual reality. And if it, like, because whenever I would go into VR, I haven't set it up in my house here, and I would go into Tilt Brush, which is a painting program, I would make these very rudimentary attempts to build a ritual chamber inside of the VR space. But I'm so clumsy when it comes to painting that I could never pull it off. It always just looked ridiculous. But do you think that if we built an Enochian chamber inside of VR, it would be as effective as building one in your house?
Well, then the question becomes, how do you have the visions? Because you're staring at a computer screen, and the computer screen is not just going to generate something out of your imagination.
But
so
what is the what's a computer screen? Afterwards. What's a computer screen? I mean, you're literally looking in. I mean, this is why they call that show Black Mirror. I mean, when you're looking at VR, you're staring at a black mirror. That is that's when my computer's off, it's a black mirror. So.
So you would shut it off after doing a ritual in VR?
No, I mean, I think that, like, what you would be gazing into, I don't know for sure, but when you're looking into VR at all, you're staring into a black mirror that has been illuminated with light. So,
right.
You know,
when you do a ritual, you set everything up and then you do it, and then you usually close your eyes and you have, like, an internal little 10-minute, 15-minute internal trip.
Oh, I see.
So I'm not really sure if you were staring at it would definitely be cool. And I think we'd have to figure out how to do it. But I think that all the magical props and all that stuff, like, there's not really any inherent magic in them. It's just, you know, all this stuff that you see in these books, like Levy or Crowley or things like that. It's just like, it's ways to, or even if you study ancient cultures and things like that, it's set in setting. As Timothy Leary said, you know, it's a way of telling yourself, okay, now I'm going to have this experience.
Right.
In the same way as if you put on a suit, you're going to feel more confident in a job interview, or if you put on athletic gear, you know, you're ready to work out. It's the same way with magic. And so ultimately these things are just kind of props, and what the real show is what your brain does. I mean, it's like a way of having a waking dream.
Yes, I get it. Yeah, you kind of, like, if you were to build a VR occult chamber, you're kind of like stealing the glory of, like, actually doing the practice. But then, you know, that being said, setting up VR and placing the goggles on, and, like, especially, God, Jesus, why don't you build this, Jason? Why don't you build us a fucking spirit chamber in virtual reality? That would be really cool, man. Like, I would love that. Like, for a true occultist to take to reproduce ritual chambers from different grimoires in VR, so
hey,
at least we could see it. Oh, I would love that.
If somebody with a startup wants to fund me to do that, you know where to find me, jweave.com. So,
guys, listen to that. That would be really cool, man. That would be really cool. It'd be so fascinating. You know, can it be done? I don't know. Could it? Would it work in the same way? Why not? Technology is magic to me. I don't understand it. And, you know, even setting up my podcast studio, every single time when I start dialing the knobs in and preparing for the conversation, I feel it as a ritual. It feels like a ritual to me.
Yes.
So,
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the more you engage in magic and the more you do it and make it a daily practice and things like that, the more it becomes the more it becomes part of you, and the more that you just see the world as a magical thing, and then you apply that, once you've been trained that way of thinking, then you apply it to other things you do. You know, you see going to your job as a ritual, you see right. the energetic transfers in things like public speaking or whatever it is. And so you begin to think, you begin to see the world as a magician, you begin to see the world as a set of systems that can be worked with and played with, and you see people's social roles as essentially performed and all of this. So really what you read in these magic books with, you know, candles and grimoires and things like that, it's training wheels in a way, you know, and I love that approach too, but it's really what you're doing is training a way of looking at the world.
Wow.
as if you're in control or that you have agency in it, and that you're interfacing with it as an intelligent phenomenon full of systems that are, you know, pretty straightforward.
Jason, every single time we have one of these conversations, my life becomes a little more magical. You are a true teacher, and I'm so grateful. Thank you for coming on the show. God, everything seems alive again, man. It was so easy to forget. It's so easy to forget. How can people find you?
So best place to find me, my website is jlouv.com, J-L-O-U-V, V as in Victor.com. Definitely check out magic.me is the place to go, magick.me. That's where I have video trainings, video classes on how to learn all of this stuff. So everything we're talking about, meditation, contacting, doing entity work, sort of contact spirits or getting into altered states, astral travel, divination, like everything. It's all there, everything that you need to get going. So it's magic.me. And if you sign up for a subscription, it's use the code
DTF8
subscription and it'll be 30% off.
Cool.
And for the first month. And there's really, it's just like we're talking about in terms of this experience. It's like you can talk about this all day long, but until you experience it, you don't really know. And also when you experience it, you realize it's something that makes sense and you've been kind of doing all along. And
right.
then it becomes a really interesting creative process to engage in. And it's I love it. It's my favorite thing. So.
And you're great.
But you have to do it. You have to do it. You can't just think about it.
Yeah, right. It's got to be experiential. If you want to dive in, dive in. We have a true magical teacher here, and startup people, VR people out there. I'm telling you, that's a cool idea. Connect with a true occultist, build some occult chambers inside of VR. That would be very interesting, man.
Or related projects. Yeah.
Jason, Hare Krishna. I love you, man. And I hope that we get to talk again.
All right. I'm glad you're enjoying New York, and I will talk to you again soon, I'm sure.
Great. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was Jason Louv. If you want to sign up for his class, go to magic.me and use the code DTFH. All the links will be at duncantrussell.com. Much thanks to Blue Apron. Go to blueapron.com/trussell. You'll get 3 free meals and free shipping, and you'll seem like a god on earth when you cook for your lovers. Thanks, you guys, for listening. We have another great podcast coming out this week with Hamilton Morris. That'll probably be out on Thursday. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.